Well, hi and welcome. This is Dave. I hope you're all doing great. I appreciate receiving the answers to the two questions that I sent around, as more of you have responded, and I appreciate it. It helps give me some idea about the kinds of things that you're each interested in, even some notion of what you hope to get out of the course, so that's immensely helpful to me. Are there things before we begin our talk today about the neuroscience of persuasion, are there things that would be helpful for us to discuss or questions that you have as you reflect on the first seminar? Anything from anyone? Or any clarifications at all?
For myself, I think it's just a challenge of translating, as you were, we talked about last week, you know, we want them to connect with us. We want it to be really a story they can relate to immediately. So how do we do that without really talking about us? But we need to talk about us in order to make that connection with what our story is and hopefully their shared story. I was playing with the language a bit.
And this is who?
This is Annette.
Annette, okay, welcome. Yes. Thank you very much. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. We want to begin with listening to the potential client or potential enrollee or customer to listen for what their needs are, what their struggle or challenge is, what their pain points are, because that's the way that we enter into a discussion and begin with where they are rather than beginning with where we are. And that's the primary thing. So when we really hear that, we can respond to that and begin an authentic conversation. Now, our conversation will be about bringing into focus the benefits that we bring in relationship to the questions or the challenges that the client has. So
sure.
That, I think, is the bridge, and it's a much more meaningful bridge. Remember, when you've begun with somebody who's, say, in sales, and they begin with a sales spiel, and they're all pumped up, and, you know, you kind of lose interest or you think it's really salesy, and I think there are two reasons for that. One is they may not begin with where you are, but beginning with where you are is both content and process. To listen to where you are in terms of what you're really interested in. I'm going to give some examples of that in this seminar, but also to begin with the same state of mind that you're in. If you're in a relaxed state, it's hard to jump aboard a train that's already going 50 miles an hour when the salesperson's all hyped up. So that sensitivity is an attunement from our perspective as coaches or as people who have content or training or other things. We need to begin with where the client is in terms of their questions, because that question will focus their attention. Then we can begin to have an exchange that they will find meaningful, and we can speak to the benefits that they have, because that will be an answer to their question.
Right.
So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I guess part of my assumption was in the class materials of marketing and persuasion, I was coming from the position of you're not yet a client. You know, I'm either meeting you one-on-one or I'm, you know, meeting and trying to, you know, market myself. So I was thinking of this as, you know, what is that sort of stock talk I'm going to have? What is my approach when I meet someone who either doesn't still know about coaching or I haven't tapped into their need and I'm talking to them fresh and making that great authentic connection where they really, you know, get and maybe identify, oh, yeah, wow, I do have a need, or yes, you really have hit on the struggle that I've been, keeping inside, and yes, I would love to have some help with that. So I think I was maybe initially coming from a different place.
Right.
And
I want to tweak what you just said, if I can. Instead of trying to market yourself, just engage in an authentic conversation with the person. You've been doing that all your life, and this is it's no different now, except this is a professional conversation, but your interest and your focus is on that client and being immersed in the listening to what that person says and what their issues are, because then you're going to have an authentic response that will be about that person and their needs and how you may build a bridge together. So that kind of response is going to sound different than trying to sell yourself or market your services, because it's going to come from a different place. Even if you use the same words, it's going to feel different to the client, because you know that you have that client's best interest at heart, and that client does too.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that will
Thank
make
you.
A difference now and later.
But, and that's reassuring, because I know that I do better in those sorts of simple, like meeting a friend sort of
Good.
Conversation versus, you know, marketing and sales positions I've had, you know, in previous careers, and it's just uncomfortable. I just
think about what's most important, and remember the study that I began last seminar with about the Wharton School of Business study. The primary
mm-hmm.
thing that determined whether someone would or wouldn't subscribe for services was the state of mind, the confidence that someone and clarity that someone stated the recommendation and the fee. The most important difference of what you just said between talking with a friend and talking with a potential client is your state of mind. When you're talking with a friend, I'll bet you're totally grounded and centered. You're immersed in that conversation. You're not taking a position to step back, even for a stutter step, to be an observer and look at what you're doing, or is this enough, or what's going to happen. You don't shift that perspective, because that changes your state of mind. You're moving from the playing field to the observer's platform. So whatever you're doing, stay immersed and stay totally engaged with the client, and it will be the thing that makes the difference, because what someone is buying, when they don't know you and they don't know what you can do, and your words might be as good as somebody else's, but they're buying the way they feel confident in you that you're going to be able to help them. And remember, one of the things we talked about last time is that why does anyone do anything that they do, whether that's buy a product, buy a service, decide to take a vacation, decide to have a dinner with someone, we decide what we're going to do on the basis of how we think it's going to make us feel. And that's the primary reason we decide things, how we think it's going to make us feel. If we think it's not going to make us feel good, we're going to do things to avoid it. If we think it's going to make us feel good, then come hell or high water, we're going to do it. We're going to figure out some way to justify or rationalize doing it. So remember that you're creating an experience from the very beginning, actually from before the beginning, because how you're branded, whether it's a blog or a website or, you know, how you're introduced, that begins before it happens, and it carries through, and you establish that, and that's what somebody's buying. Whatever the mm-hmm. words are and whatever other reasons make it make sense, to do it or not to do it, they're going to be motivated primarily by that, and your confidence, your state of mind, is going to be a huge central factor in that. And I think you've just gotten at the heart of what I wanted to convey last time in asking that, and to summarize it in that way. So thanks very much, Annette. I think that's, you know, that's
pretty That's great. Thank
yeah.
you.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other comments or questions or things you'd like to talk about briefly before we begin? Okay, well, I'll be sure and preserve some time at the end, because I want to get your thoughts or any questions or clarifications about our topic. We're going to talk about the neuroscience of persuasion. And remember, you have a fairly thorough and annotated outline so that you don't have to take notes. You can just kind of listen to see how much of this makes sense. I want to begin with two quizzes, like we did last time. And the two quizzes are in your outline. First quiz, it's multiple choice. Ohio State University studied several hundred undergraduates and asked them to rate how much they wanted and liked various pleasurable activities. Receiving a paycheck, seeing a best friend, engaging in sexual activity, receiving a compliment or getting a good grade, eating a favorable food. Now the hint here is one of these was endorsed more than all the other four combined. It's the one that's the generator of self-esteem. The other four are markers of self-esteem. The answer? The students valued boosts to their self-esteem, such as receiving good grades or compliments, more than any other experiences. It's the basic desire that we have to be effective, and esteem is living into one's ideal. Fourth quiz. The American Sociological Review studied the hiring practices of three elite industries, law, investment banking, management consulting firms, to discern the primary criteria for those qualified to make the final round of interviews. What do you think it was? Intellectual prestige, primarily where they obtained a degree, grade point average, sharing similar experiences with the interviewer, expertise in the area of the position sought, and recommendations for the position. It's the same as with purchase decisions. We buy what fits our identity. Sharing a similar experience with the interviewer helped move the person into the final round more than any of the other aspects that I mentioned. Now, I want to talk about persuasion in this seminar with you. Persuasion can be simply defined as the process of getting your prospect to clearly associate a most desired feeling or state with your product or service. People buy people to connect to a person they know, like, and trust. When I was about 9 years old, it was time to buy a new coat for school. I went to the city close to the farm outside the little town where I lived. We looked at coats at three stores, because that's all there were. At one store, I really liked the sales guy. He was a warm, engaging, funny guy, and seemed to take a genuine interest in me. The coat I was looking there was a light blue, a kind of a soft velour with an elastic bottom, sort of a balloon effect. You kind of pretty much had to be there. He said, "Man, you look really good in that coat." Now, nobody had ever told me I looked good in a coat before. I knew right then that was the coat I was going to buy. I just had to convince my mom. I emphasized to my mom how much I wanted that coat. Now, I didn't particularly like the coat, but I really liked the salesman. I liked the coat even less when I got home. That salesman had done a splendid job. I couldn't grow out of that coat fast enough. For 3 years, every time it got cold, I had vague memories of a really nice salesman while I looked like my head was on top of a light blue marshmallow. Now, for persuasion, let's talk about the art and science of explanation. We all, to some degree, have to overcome the curse of knowledge. The curse of knowledge is the difficulty we have in imagining what it's like to not know what we know. Combined with another fatal mistake, and I've shared that so many times, to share all of what we know. One of the most profound challenges is to simplify. Although valuable, the knowledge we bring to the table, especially if we get into a teaching mode, is going to inhibit our ability to engage in conversation and to communicate in a simple, clear, succinct way. It's said that marketers, and we've got to include ourselves in that because we're professionals who sell our services, usually make three mistakes: assuming people are rational, assuming people are eager for change, and assuming that once somebody knows things the way you know them, they're going to choose what you choose or what you recommend. And remember, if information were enough, if information would change behavior, we'd all be thin. We'd work out every day. We'd eat mostly vegetables. we'd have a lot of money saved. And there would be a number of librarians who would be billionaires, by the way, too. Some effective ideas about explanations that are distilled from a number of neuroscience studies of explanations for impact and retention are what I want to share with you now. This is a brief overview, and then we'll incorporate them in the principles of persuasion. So these are the kind of the headline ideas. One, don't bury the lead. State in your first sentence what issue or problem you address and the benefits you bring. If it's a presentation, state your intentions right up front. This prepares an audience for an explanation, and it frames listening. How many times have you listened to somebody, you're trying to figure out what the point is, and you can't hold all the information they've given you until they finally light on something that makes it make sense, so you kind of tune out a little bit. Second, listen carefully. People give clues throughout a conversation that we can miss if we're thinking about what we're going to say next. Keep it short. When you speak to others, they will only be able to really retain and use about 10 words before their minds wander off to process what you just said. This principle of brevity is really hard to adhere to because we usually think we have to explain everything if the other person is to understand us. So we speak too fast, use too many words, which eclipses the processing, the understanding, and the retention of the other person. Anything more than 10 to 12 words is just too much for the other person's brain to process and recall. And remember to ask if the other person understands what we just said. Let me give you an example of this. If you only have 10 words to say what you say, and still speaking on and on, you really have to think about what's the essence of what you want to say. But think about if you have 10 words, to speak more briefly, with power, with clarity, and persuasiveness, consider the 10-10 principle. 10 words and 10 fingers. This will quickly train your brain to use 10 words in order to speak with clarity, brevity, and simplicity. Hold your hands up in front of you. Make a fist with both hands. Raise one finger every time you speak a word. When you run out of fingers, you stop speaking. A colleague of mine, whose work I've come to know and we've collaborated and plan to do some retreats together, Mark Waldman at Loyola Marymount, the Executive MBA faculty, his last book I would highly recommend, Words Can Change Your Brain. When he's done research using this 10-10 principle in charged situations, emotionally charged like divorce, mediation, negotiation, arbitration, these situations were resolved faster on the average of 10 to 25% of the usual time that it took, and they reached more satisfying and complete conclusions when both sides agreed to this. One side would speak up to 10 words, and it was the other side's turn. Next, reduce noise. Include only what is simple and relevant. Use visuals. Many people are visual learners. Visuals can captivate an audience in a way that words can't. Match the medium and the message. For example, a cooking show on the radio is a mismatch. Embrace imperfection. Be more concerned about substance and understanding than a polished design and perfection. This especially applies to if you have a planned spiel, like an elevator speech. Forget about that. On the elevator, ask what's your primary challenge in your life or your business instead of giving your elevator speech. Slow down. Be accessible. Have fun. States of mind are contagious. My favorite grandmother said, if you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. So here are six principles of persuasion. Persuasion appeals to deeply rooted human responses of mind and brain. Social psychology and recently neuroscience studies have identified these six basic principles of persuasion. First principle of persuasion, liking. And this is distilled from a large number of studies and research to six simple principles that cut across all of these. liking. We like people who like us. We buy from people we like. Remember my salesman guy. The application. Discover real similarities, genuine connections, and offer authentic comments. I want to tell you my Magic Johnson story. When my son and daughter began playing basketball in grade school and I was coaching them, we had season tickets for the Houston Rockets. Two seats, and they would each do a draft themselves at the beginning of the season to pick who went to what game with me, and we had dinner before the game and went to the game. When the Lakers were in town, they were each excited about seeing Magic Johnson. Before the game began, I gave them each a quiz. I said, I want you to notice one thing, how he plays, and see what you can pick up about what his strategy is, especially about how he relates to everybody on the court. So after the game, ask them what they noticed, and to not tell the other about the answer, no trouble with that. They each mentioned how he seemed to be great friends with everybody on the court, including the other team players and the referees. What else, I ask? They each mentioned some aspect of how much he actually fouled, but he never seemed to be called for the fouls. Exactly. Everybody on the court likes him, and the referees especially liked him, and he genuinely seemed to like them. He was in a relationship with each of them, even while the game was going on. He was an expert at handling relationships as he was the ball, and they hardly ever called a foul on him. They participate in his success. They would be less likely to feel that they participate in that success if they had to call a foul and disrupt or derail the flow of that state of good energy experience with him. When people like you and sense that you have something in common, they're more likely to say yes. It's the law of attraction in action. People essentially do business with and refer business to those who they like, know, and trust. People commit not to things, but to people who they believe care about them. We tend to work with, to associate with, to purchase things from people who share our sense of what's important, our priorities. So it becomes important to establish commonalities that maybe aren't immediately visible by specifically addressing these values. We prefer to say yes to the request of someone we know and like. The simple principle is used in hundreds of ways by total strangers to get us to comply with their request. Remember that slightly embarrassed kid who looked like a blue marshmallow in cold weather? Now, the crucial question, what are the factors that cause one person to like another person? One is the halo effect. A halo effect occurs when one positive characteristic of a person dominates the way that person is viewed by others. Examples are kindness, honesty, intelligence. We're always teaching people how to respond to us. And I want to emphasize here, I'm not pointing out these things for any kind of less than authentic response. I'm highlighting them so that when you have and know these qualities, you can put them forward and not be embarrassed about doing that because you think you should be professional. Another similarity. We like people who are similar to us, similar backgrounds, interests, age, religion, politics. When Roger Dooley, the author of Brainfluence, and I would highly recommend this. I'm going to speak to some parts of it in the final seminar. It's Brainfluence. It's applying neuroscience to neuromarketing. When Roger talked about this when he was the expert content contributor at our mastermind group not too long ago, he illustrated that by pointing out how I use something I knew we personally had in common in my introduction of him and how it made him feel when he did that. Another, compliments. The greatest car salesman in the world, Joe Girard, said that the secret of success was liking his clients and letting it show. Each month he sent every one of his more than 13,000 former clients a greeting card and a personal message, and the message never varied. It read, I like you. And people who knew him said he authentically meant it, and he could recall each of these farmer clients. And another, contact and cooperation. For the most part, we like things that are familiar to us. By providing people with different backgrounds, with more exposure to one another as equals, they come to like each other better. Mr. Rogers carried in his wallet a statement that said, "Frankly, there isn't anyone you couldn't learn to love once you've heard their story." We are wired to connect with others. A study in Edinburgh planted hundreds of wallets on city streets. The wallets contained one of four possible photos: a smiling baby, a cute puppy, a happy family, or an elderly couple. Other wallets had no photo at all. 88% of the wallets with the baby photo were returned. 53% of the puppy photo were returned. 48% with the family photo were returned. 28% with an elderly couple were returned. Less than 1 in 7 with no photo were returned. Our brains are wired to connect emotionally with others. The second principle of persuasion, reciprocity. We repay, we respond in kind. The application, give what you want to receive. Your income is determined by how many people you serve and how well you serve them. People return favors. When we help people, they want to help us. It induces the brain chemical of connection and bonding, oxytocin. When you behave in a certain way, such as cooperatively, people will respond in kind. We try to repay in kind what another person has provided us. There's a sense of indebtedness that the recipient experiences and wants to discharge the obligation. We have serious persuasive power immediately after someone thanks us. And I like the responses. Well, of course, it's what partners do for each other. In a number of studies, reciprocity is so strong that it overwhelmed other factors. In one study, success in selling raffle tickets was most effective for subjects who received an early favor of receiving a Coke. The feeling that the recipient owed the giver something resulted in them buying twice as many tickets as those who had not been given the prior favor. Think about the address labels you receive as a gift with a request for a donation. And here's an example of the importance of framing. One of Johnny Carson's guests on The Tonight Show was the Girl Scout who sold the most cookies that year. The young lady, Marquita Andrews, set an all-time cookie sales record in all of Girl Scouts. What was her technique? In addition to hard work, she used a strategy to frame her customer's view of the purchase. Here's her strategy. When Marquita knocked on the door, she would first ask for a $25,000 donation to the Girl Scouts, and she would ask in all seriousness. Well, naturally, she had no takers on that request. But then she'd ask if they would at least buy a box of Girl Scout cookies. Just about everyone did. By the initial framing of the $25,000 number, she made a few bucks for some cookies seem trivial. This was written up most recently in Success Magazine, December 23, 2008. The third principle of persuasion, social proof. We follow the lead of similar others. The application here, use peer power whenever it's available. Get testimonials, endorsements. We do things we see other people doing, especially if those people seem similar to us, and that's a clue, a cue. Social proof is the way we determine what is correct, popular, or even acceptable. We find out what other people think about it. How many times have you thought about a book on Amazon, been a little uncertain, and zipped down to see what place it stands in terms of purchase, and then what other people say about it? Like other tools of influence, it's a convenient shortcut for determining how we may behave. We assume an action is more correct if others do it. When I'm invited to a social function, and I'm not certain about the dress, which is not infrequent, I'll call somebody I know who's attending and ask, are you wearing a tux or a suit, or is this kind of casual? Then I know at least one other person won't be dressed like me. Another example, bartenders salt tip jars with a few dollar bills at the beginning of the evening to simulate and stimulate tips left by, to simulate tips left by prior clients to simulate current ones, to give the impression that tipping with folding money is proper barroom behavior. In a study in San Diego, researchers hung four flyers on doorknobs. One said, homeowners should conserve energy because it helps the environment. One said, saving energy was socially responsible. One said, it saved money. Another said, the majority of neighbors in the community were doing it. The researchers found that the houses with the fourth flyer, the majorities of neighbors in the community were doing it, showed the most change. In fact, it showed more than the other three combined. Simply urging people or telling them it's a good idea to recycle or conserve energy was the least effective. Another extensive study showed this contagion effect in everyday life to examine the amount of food eaten in different contexts. At restaurants, on average, and this is a large study, alone, the least amount. Eating with one other person, 35% more food consumed. With a party of four, 75% more food consumed. In a party of seven or more, 96% more food consumed. Now, the uncontrolled variable here was the amount of alcohol, but stick with the numbers here. When we're unsure of ourselves and the situation is unclear or ambiguous, the greater uncertainty makes us more likely to look to and accept the actions of others as a guide for correctness. Successful influence is governed more by context than cognition. This is the power of testimonials of previous users or clients or esteemed figures. An example, for an event that you want to influence attendance, first invite the people who are most likely to attend anyway. Then, to the next group of people, emphasize how the first group has responded. A fourth principle of persuasion, commitment and consistency. We have a deeply held motivation to behave consistently with commitments we've made. The application, make commitments active, public, and voluntary. When a commitment is voluntary and made concrete, written or publicly, people are more likely to follow through. Here's a practical example of how you can get clients to more consistently follow through on a commitment for an initial appointment. I'd like you to think back for just a moment how you do that. How do you get clients, or even think about what might make clients more consistent in following through on a commitment for an initial appointment? A series of experiments were conducted at three busy doctor's offices where patients, immediately after being provided with a date and time in a standard appointment-making call, were asked to read, this is on the telephone, to read back out loud those appointment details before hanging up the phone. This verbal commitment resulted in a significant increase in follow-through. A variation, though, of that had an even greater effect. It was for the receptionist to simply ask the patient to write down the time and date of the next appointment on the card. The result was an 18% reduction in no-shows in that group. The client does it, makes it part of their output channel, part of their story. The client is less committed to the program or to the appointment when the professional writes out the plan or the date, rather than when the client does, including something as simple as the appointment time. In instances where it's not reasonable for the client to write the instructions or to actively participate in this way, it's more productive to have an indication form. For example, the recipient of an email to have a simple check, yes, to have them indicate that this is their understanding of the information in the agreement. In this way, They respond simply by saying yes or checking, and this enhances commitment dates. This is real easy with emails to check with somebody, to set up an appointment, and then get them to confirm. After that, I would recommend having every appointment as a standing time. That way you don't have to figure it out every time. It is a commitment that you both make. These are all ways to help people take ownership of their own stories, and they're going to have more commitment and more resolve and perseverance when it's their story rather than somebody else's. We each have a basic desire to be and appear consistent with what we've already done. In other words, once we make a choice, we justify and rationalize that choice. We gather data to confirm it, a confirmation bias, selectively omit data that may refute it, and inattentional blindness. These internal and external pressures will cause us to respond in ways that justify our earlier decision. We make our beliefs and perceptions consistent with what we've already decided, in other words. This principle of consistency is powerful enough to direct both our perception and our action. A desire for consistency is strong enough to be a central motivator and organizer of our behavior. This principle is fundamental to our motivation to maintain the status quo, the default mode, the continuity of no change. A body at rest tends to stay at rest, while a body in motion tends to stay in motion. We simply find ways for this principle to benefit our clients and us, because we know a client is going to, if other things are equal, stick with the default mode, which means to not engage in the professional services that may be of significant benefit to them. Now, two main factors are in play at maintaining a status quo and not changing. Automatic responding offers a shortcut through all the confusion and the enormity of the information we face in daily life. We simply don't have to expend the mental energy to weigh the pros and cons or make tough decisions, but we resort to the default consistency. Automatic consistency offers us a way to avoid all the rigors and the energy of continuing deliberation. And secondly, we avoid the work of initiating a new action by continuing the same one. Think about how continuity programs utilize this characteristic. You give your credit, each of you have done this, I know. You give your credit card number as a way to sign up for 3 free months of a subscription. Then you're charged beginning the 4th month unless you unsubscribe. 82% of people do not initiate another action of unsubscribing, but maintain the consistency of the subscription. How many do you guess continue reading the remaining subscriptions that they automatically continue with? 62% do not read the remaining subscriptions, even though they've not unsubscribed, because that takes a separate initiative. Automatic consistency and maintenance of the status quo functions as a shield against further thought and deliberation. So, now how can you make positive use of this consistency principle in your own business? Well, to obtain a large purchase, start with a small one. Findings show that almost any small sale will do, like an ebook for a couple of bucks, because the purpose of the initial small transaction is not profit, but it's commitment. Further purchases to progressively larger ones flow naturally from the commitment. And it gives somebody an indication of the value, the benefit they'll get in your services. The small purchase converts a prospect to a client, and then once a client, you are able to benefit that client tremendously. The fifth principle of persuasion, authority. We defer to experts and those in authority. One application, expose your expertise. Don't assume it's self-sufficient. When you need someone to advance your case, product, or service, having an agent or an advocate can be very helpful. You're perceived as being more prestigious if someone is advocating for you. This is the authority principle in action, an application of the halo effect. This is the idea behind book blurbs or endorsements from respected authorities. When you develop, and here's an application, When you negotiate with an organization to offer them a program or service, first develop an internal champion within the organization who advocates and can provide information. That person serves as your authority. The sixth persuasion principle, scarcity. We tend to want more of what we can have less of. The application, highlight unique benefits and exclusive information. People value things more when they perceive them to be scarce. G.K. Chesterton said it very simply, the way to love anything is to realize it might be lost. Now here's an application. Caitlin, my granddaughter, who was 4 at the time, was playing with a stuffed bear in her pre-kindergarten class. Sarah, her little buddy, suddenly decided that she wanted to play with that bear as well. There were many other toys around, no bear deficit. So Sarah, though, was no longer satisfied until she had Caitlin's stuffed bear. Caitlin's mother, my daughter Lauren, a clinical psychologist, was rendered as helpless as Caitlin's absent granddad Dave in orchestrating her mastery to maintain possession of the coveted bear, or to work out a compromise for all-or-nothing 4-year-old possession-minded girls. Caitlin will later learn how her own desires will be influenced by neuromarketing techniques based on celebrity induction, social valuation, and popular trending stuffed bears. Even the induced shortage of stuffed bears. But for now, she has only impromptu strategies to wrest her bear from the evil clutches of Sarah's immediate inspired desire. Both girls were in the grips of the scarcity principle. When something becomes rare or scarce, it becomes more valuable, enhancing desire. When increasing scarcity interferes with our access, or with our access to something, we react by wanting to possess it even more. Later in their lives, both Caitlin and Sarah will contend with marketing messages that are adult versions of the bear story. Limited number. Only 2 left. 1 day remaining. We're not making any more of these. Mimetic desire, which is one person's desire mimicking that of another, is not limited to children, but plays a significant role in product adoption of best-selling goods. Our neuron system contributes to this contagion of desire. The more value the person, the more attention we pay to that mirroring process. Opportunities and objects seem more valuable to us when their availability is limited. The scarcity principle involves a secondary source of power. As opportunities become less available, we lose freedom and choice, and we hate to lose the freedom and choice we already have, and we desire to preserve our established prerogatives. Daniel Kahneman won a Nobel Prize by showing that if you want to mobilize people under conditions of uncertainty, losing something has twice the impact than the gain of the same amount or object has pleasure. Remember, we discussed loss aversion in the previous seminar. So we need to couple not just what would be gained by acting or purchasing, but what would be lost or foregone if someone does not act or purchase and continues what they're doing now. So when increasing scarcity interferes with our access to something, we'll react against the interference by wanting and trying to possess the item even more than before. A related tendency is to want what's been banned and to pursue and to presume that it's more worthwhile when it's limited. This scarcity principle works for messages, communications, and knowledge, in that we value limited or exclusive information. Louis Neisser said, some people will believe anything if you whisper it to them. Here's an application. And I didn't even know this at the time or what principle I was applying. I did it kind of intuitively. After I completed my subspecialty training in psychoanalysis, I was invited to join the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Institute. I was even more excited when I was also offered a continuing education course, which was kind of at the time a plum, in the evening for the professional community and on any subject I chose. I was warned not to be disappointed if the enrollment was low, because the highest subscription for any course that had been offered to date was 7 people. And the average for the seminars was 4 to 7, and occasionally courses had to be dropped because there wasn't enough registration or no registration. So the first thing I did in announcing the course was to stipulate, and this was an authentic move at the time, was to stipulate that there was a maximum of 12 seats available to ensure optimum discussion. I was an optimist. I didn't know consciously about the scarcity principle then. In the first 2 days, 14 people signed up, and the waiting list grew. The most important thing in knowing and applying these persuasion principles is to be authentic, to genuinely have your client's best interests at heart. Remember that all influence factors have to be genuine, trustworthy, and ethical. So here's an application of persuasion science. Why we buy. People will buy your product or service when they feel pressure. There are two kinds of pressure, external and internal. External from the outside, such as through TV or sales person or coming across it on the internet, and internal pressure created by an innate desire. Of the two, internal pressure and internal rewards are way more powerful, since people buy for their own reasons. People buy wants first and needs later. From social neuroscience, we know the twin forces of motivation, the two forces that drive all human behavior, the desire to avoid pain and the desire to seek pleasure. These two organizing principles of the brain, to minimize danger or pain and to maximize reward or pleasure, are overarching. If we associate positive emotions or reward, we approach. If we associate negative emotions or pain, we avoid. If someone buys something, they associate more pleasure to buying than not buying. If someone doesn't buy, they associate more pain to buying than not buying. And we process the pleasure and pain cues unconsciously within a fifth of a second. Remember, we buy things because of the anticipation it's going to make us feel good. A master formula of persuasion to associate buying with getting pleasure and not buying with pain. People will do more to avoid pain than to seek pleasure, the risk aversion. Therefore, we need to sell consequences, positive consequences if they do, negative consequences if they don't. We desire results brought about by gain and positive movement in our lives. We fear the pain of consequences of not doing what's needed. Think about how much of what we do is to prevent pain. Paying bills, doing taxes, exercising, maintaining your car or house. Prevent pain, do gain. Failing to complete any of the broad spectrum of prevent pain tasks can produce significant negative results. Doing gain tasks can produce significant positive results. This means that an important way to prioritize tasks is to look at results produced. Our brains are hardwired to prioritize survival over improvement, to prevent pain over gain, to avoid pain rather than seek pleasure. This means that our brains are not necessarily a mechanism designed for success, fulfillment, and growth, but for survival, as a first priority at least, for the immediacy of avoiding pain as well as gaining pleasure. So, three steps. These are the, and remember, as we go over these, remember the three building blocks of compelling stories. This is going to be the same three steps here. The three building blocks of compelling stories: challenge, struggle, and resolution. These building blocks are common to all successful stories, from effective marketing to best-selling novels and films. One, find the problem, the pain, the challenge. Find the deep want or interest that's not fulfilled. What they want but are not getting. What are they not able to do or be themselves? The foundation of effective selling. is to highlight the continuing pain or unmet need if they don't purchase. Number two, to illuminate the struggle, to find the motivation. Crystallize awareness by asking questions. Motivators are all emotional. Clarify and define them by focus, by asking questions. Do you want to have the best? To be smarter? To be confident? To have the most successful practice? These are not ones you ask directly necessarily, but these are orienting for you as you listen to the challenges. And third is resolution. Show them how to resolve the challenge, how to heal their discomfort by using your product or service, what they can't do or be themselves that they now will be able to do with your product or service. The persuasion process is of getting your client to clearly associate the most desired feeling or state with your product or service. Make it compelling and real. We want emotionally, but justify logically. Find the emotional reason, their reason, to buy it now. They'll take care of the justification and probably do it better than you will. Strategies that simply inform people about making a change are most likely to fail. It's not information that leads people to make decisions. People don't buy products. They buy states of mind. Whatever we associate to something determines our behavior. To change behavior, change the associative link. Link the message to a fundamental human emotion. Again, people buy for emotional reasons and then justify with logic. The most significant thing that great influencers and persuaders understand that they keep in mind, that they communicate. It's not about you, it's about them, the client. And remember your primary question, what is it that you want to accomplish through this? When President Abraham Lincoln was a successful lawyer prior to his presidency, he began presenting a case by establishing a positive frame for him and his clients that created a distinct advantage. He would begin his opening arguments by summing up the other side's case. He would point out the positive aspects of their position, how worthy of consideration they were in establishing his credibility by demonstrating that he recognized the other side had a legitimate view. When he then presented his client's side, he established that as well and in detail, and he was listened to very carefully because his credibility was high. The judge and jury both concluded that if he was so willing to give credibility to the viewpoint of the other side, he must be honest in speaking from his heart. An effective way to positively and gently persuade is to win someone over by pointing out their side of the story. Empathic resonance in action. Discover and vocalize their point of view to show them you not only understand their point of view, but you also get how it makes sense. This frame of respect and understanding of the other person's point of view will be effective in then establishing your position. So, I want to conclude with how this bridges to the four primary tools of persuasion. These are actual tools. One, relatedness. For long-term impact, you have to care about people and find a way of communicating that feeling of caring. Empathy is the ability to resonate with someone else's experience, including feelings, perspective, ways of constructing meaning, that person's subjective reality. Our ability to influence and persuade depend not only on our ability to empathically understand the other person, but to communicate that understanding. This is always the first step, to empathically resonate with someone, to build a common ground of understanding. It's the first step in every coaching engagement that you have. Everything else follows. If you're not exactly right, the other person appreciates that you've attempted to understand, and they'll correct you. When you listen empathically and communicate that understanding, the other person feels truly heard. This is the essence of effectiveness, to be understood. And it can at times make the difference between helplessness and hope, discouragement and determination. Remember how an experience of connecting with another person releases oxytocin in the brain, further enhancing affiliation and trust. The more people trust one another, the greater the collaboration and shared information. An experiment was done with a team of British physicians in which they reminded their patients to attend their next appointment. When the patient's first name was used in the reminder versus a reminder without the name, it led to a 57% reduction in the rate of no-shows. The second tool of persuasion, autonomy. Having control over the environment and the choices we make generates our experience of significance to feel important, unique. This is one of our six basic human needs. When you understand what people believe and how they make decisions, you can help them show how buying your product or service is consistent with their beliefs. This is the essence of selling. Find out beliefs, discover motivations, show you care, and determine the focus and state of mind of the conversation. Third tool of persuasion, certainty. This is another basic human need, one of the six. The need to be certain that we can avoid pain and achieve pleasure. The brain is a pattern recognition machine that consistently tries to predict the near future. The act of creating a sense of certainty is rewarding. Think about how we repeat patterns, how we listen to the same music, how we go back to the places we've been. Change creates uncertainty. Even a small amount of uncertainty generates a response from the error detection mechanism in our brains. So we can increase certainty by making concepts tangible, such as how long a meeting will run, and explicit, such as the objectives. A lot of the field of management addresses increasing the sense of certainty in times of change and transition. Now, these first three primary tools of persuasion are synonymous with three of the basic six human needs. A fourth tool of persuasion is state management. Manage your emotion and states of mind. Reset after every play. We're going to send all of Seminar 3 on this topic, but I just want to preface it just briefly by saying focus is one of the two most powerful ways we regulate states of mind. We determine someone's focus by the questions we ask. Asking questions is our most powerful tool to persuade someone. And the way we ask the question really frames the answer. So here are some primary questions from the client's point of view. What's in it for me? What is it? Can you prove it? Will it give me what I want and need? Will it be worth it? Will I be able to justify it? And do I need it now? Now, here are some things from your unique position. What do you do uniquely well better than anyone else? What skills do you have that people find interesting and ask you about? When somebody refers business to you, what do they tell others about you? If you're not sure, ask. Why do your clients continually refer to you, to your products or services? And what are the specific needs of your clients that your product or services will actually fill? Accentuate and boldly proclaim your distinctness to a specific audience. You have to stand out. When you narrow your focus, you increase your appeal. And a final application for our discussion of persuasion. What's your niche? Who specifically do you want to persuade? Niche is about marketing, not about specialization or expertise, but how to target market in order to direct energy and inform a specific conversation. And I'm only going to mention an overview of three perspectives of this: avatars, ecosystems, and watering holes. Avatars are just ideal collaborators, our clients, and they can be defined by demographics, profession or business, loves technology, special interests like reentry into work after parenting, specific entrepreneurs like women small business owners or parents of adolescent ADD kids. These are all terrific niches because they tell you specifically where to go for your collaborators, for your referral sources, your portals of entry. Ecosystems, second, the broad network of avatar affiliations. Ecosystems are the specific areas or businesses or markets frequented or products used or websites utilized. And finally, watering holes, the specific locations where a large number of avatars or clients hang out, where you will cross paths literally or figuratively with potential clients, because you have to go to the watering holes and listen carefully to how they describe their challenges and your problems. You then address those challenges by your services or products using their language, not yours. Become an expert about your client's experiences, needs, and challenges. And another thing, I know we're out of time. Give me 30 more seconds here, and my apologies about no discussion. One thing I want to specifically emphasize is to know the gatekeeper. Gatekeepers determine the access and control to a portal of potentially qualified individuals. For example, many years ago, when I completed my residency in psychiatry and joined the faculty at Baylor College of Medicine, I was one of seven new faculty who each also wanted to develop a limited private practice alongside the faculty position. When I got my first referral, it was from the secretary of the department chairman. Well, I thought, of course, that's where people new in town who don't have a referring physician or who may be embarrassed to ask their family doc to recommend a shrink would go, to the chairman of the most prestigious medical school in the region. So I personally went down to thank her. Next referral, same thing. Each referral, a personal follow-up. Christmas, a gift. When our new faculty group of seven met in the spring, each of them mentioned a disappointment in getting referrals. They had none to one patient. At that time, I had eight. The nurturing of referral sources, especially of gatekeepers. So, get clear about your definition of success. Define the specific characteristics of an idea. Identify the ecosystem and determine the watering hole. Remember this principle of commitment to yourself and to consistency. Practice the basics daily, especially after you're successful. True masters never stop practicing the basics. My apologies about not having discussion time. I got a little bit more elaborative about some of my stories that I planned. If there are questions or follow-up comments or clarifications, please send them to me in an email. And I look forward to picking up right here next time. We will meet on Monday, even though it's the Monday of Thanksgiving week. Thanks very much, and I hope this was helpful and interesting.